The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Its motto is, "Things happen when people start talking." You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. Annual sponsors for the City Club are Northwest Nazarene University, Red Sky, and the Idaho Humanities Council. The moderator for this forum is Bill Manny.
Welcome to the City Club of Boise. I'm your moderator, Bill Manny. I'm an editor at the Idaho Statesman, and I'm past president of City Club. I'd like to welcome our radio audience listening on KBSX, Boise State Public Radio 91.5. City Club's forum series sponsors are Micron, Perkins Coie, and Echelon. And our media sponsors are Boise State Public Radio and Peppershock Media. So please join me in thanking them for their support. All right, to start today's program, I'd like to quote a leading figure in the debate over reforming the American healthcare system. As this expert says, "Nobody knew healthcare could be so complicated." All right, you may recognize that was President Trump, and that was February 27th as Congress was beginning to discuss how to repeal and replace Obamacare. Our topic today is one of the most important and most vexing that our society faces. What's the best way to ensure that Americans and Idahoans have access to health care and health insurance? What's the best way to pay for that care? And what is our obligation as a society to pay for people who can't or won't pay for themselves? Well, if it were easy, it would be done. In 2010, the Affordable Care Act was passed, and it gave government coverage to the very poorest families in America, and it offered low-income working people public subsidies to buy their own insurance. But there was a catch. The Supreme Court ruled that states had the option whether to extend Medicaid coverage to the group in between. Those are the people who made too much for Medicaid and not enough to buy their own with assistance on the exchange. For 2017, that cutoff at 138% of the federal poverty level was $16,643. For an individual, and $33,948 for a family of four. And I'm hoping our experts will correct me if I get any of this wrong, because it's complicated. Who knew it was this complicated? Anyway, this group of people in between is known as the gap group, and it's estimated to be as many as 78,000 people in Idaho. Now, other states are wrestling with this very same issue. 31 states have expanded Medicaid. 19 have not, including Idaho. Now, Idaho has formally studied its options for addressing this gap group three different times. And the last time, the Legislative Interim Committee all agreed that we should do something, including our speaker on our left. It's just, what is that something? Nobody's figured that out yet. Add to Idaho's uncertainty the changing landscape in Washington. Republicans and President Trump campaign on getting rid of Obamacare. The first effort to repeal and replace it last month failed. And that would have had all kinds of new twists for how and when states can cover this Medicaid gap group. Congress this very week is again trying to figure out if it has enough votes to take this on again. Our two guests know how complicated this is. Senator Marv Hagedorn is a Republican from Meridian. He served three terms in the House before being elected to the Senate, where he is serving his third term. He was co-chair of the 2016 Legislative Working Group on Alternatives to Bridging the Gap. He was also the author of an unsuccessful 2017 bill that would have taken a modest step to expand care to the gap group, using state dollars, not federal. He grew up in North Idaho. He spent 20 years in the U.S. Navy, and then he became CEO of a company that imported farm and construction equipment. By the way, he's also a candidate for lieutenant governor in 2018. Corey Serber is the State Affairs Director for St. Alphonsus Regional Medical Center. She facilitated both rounds of the Governor's Work Group on Medicaid Expansion in 2012 and 2014. And that group, those groups recommended that Idaho draft its own plan and seek a federal waiver in order to make it happen. She grew up in Eastern Oregon. She teaches health policy at Boise State, and among her other community activities, she's chairman of the United Way Board. All right, I'm going to get back to the question I was about to ask you, which is, why is this so complicated? And let me ask it this way. Idaho figured out how to create a successful health insurance exchange, what has by all accounts been one of the best run in the country. So Idaho knows how to do this. So Senator, why don't we use that model and address the gap population?
Thank you, Bill. And I think that's a great question. But I think if we go back in history to understand how we got to that healthcare exchange, even that was not a very easy task. And that's just a very small portion of the problem. And if you think about it, the healthcare exchange that we created, when that happened, we had two choices. Either the federal government would go ahead and create the exchange for us, or we could create the exchange. And our choice was to do that because we maintained control over regulating the insurance, approving who could pay for the insurance, all of those types of things. Now, you might also not hear in that discussion anything about healthcare. Although it's called a healthcare exchange, the only thing it's really doing is insurance and putting insurance on the table so people can go, and we actually created ours so you could actually window shop. One of the advantages we had was you could just put in your zip code what your expected income was going to be for a year, and then you could see what policies you would be eligible for. None of the federal exchanges do that. But because we controlled our exchange, we could allow folks to go in and window shop and see what that was. But again, that was just for insurance. And the premise for the exchange before the ACA was created was to create some transparency in healthcare in general, to try and allow doctors, providers, insurance companies, everyone to be able to sell their wares on a vehicle that provided enough transparency for the public to be able to go in and make choices. And that was, in the ACA, was set up to do just insurance. And then we had the 10 essential benefits that each insurance company was required to put on that. And we've not really addressed the cost of healthcare, which is a big issue in the whole insurance, in the whole debate. And so someone was mentioning earlier today about how big this problem is and why it's not been solved. It is because trying to wrap your arms around the insurance industry and the healthcare delivery and providers industry, they're two different animals, is really, really complex and hard to do.
So, Corey, if it is this complicated, wouldn't it breaking it down and saying to lawmakers, look, you figured out how to handle the exchange, apply the same model to the gap population. Why do you think that hasn't resonated with lawmakers?
Sure. And I'm going to take it up a level from there and talk about why healthcare is so complicated in this country. And that is because we've evolved a healthcare system like none other in the world. You could argue, in some respects, that we do have the best healthcare system in the world. If you are a premature baby born at 28 weeks, we have capabilities to enable that child to survive. If you have any number of cancers, you probably have a better chance of survival here than anywhere else in the world. Our capabilities are incredible. Our professionals, our research, they're incredible. We spend more per capita than any other industrialized country. But when you look at the outcomes for the population as a whole, we don't stack up to these other countries because we focus on sick care and fixing what's wrong rather than getting ahead of that and focusing on things like primary care and prevention. Add on top of that, that our healthcare system has evolved into a mosaic of public and private programs. We have a deep philosophical divide between the political parties about what the proper role of government is, what the proper role of our tax dollars are when it comes to healthcare. That's more clearly delineated when it comes to education, that sort of thing, but we come back to this question of whether do we view healthcare as a right? And I could argue that we've decided that in policy that it is. President Reagan signed into law EMTALA, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, that makes it so that anybody can come into our emergency room and they are entitled to receive care. We've decided that over age 65, you are entitled to receive Medicare coverage. We have Medicaid coverage. But we still have this deep divide about how far should this go? How far should this right to health care go? And so take it to the exchange discussion. That argument came out very strongly about really should this be a free market thing or should it be a vehicle to help people get assistance, the low-income folks get assistance. So I think that we really have to realize what makes it complex under the surface, just the how the healthcare system looks, and that is incredibly complex. And it's a tough ship to turn. And then, you know, just looking at this gap situation, every argument comes back to what is the proper role of government in healthcare.
So I want to take on that question, but since you raised the basic human right question, the three of our first 10 questions addressed that. Congressman Labrador at his town hall meetings in the last week got this question over and over again. Is healthcare a basic human right? I think you've articulated why Ronald Reagan may have created that or advanced that. What do you think, Senator?
It's not in our Constitution. It's pretty clear. It's not in our Constitution. President Reagan, for as much as I love him, I think passing the EMTALA law was part of our problem. When we get federal government, when we overregulate, in that case, it was the providers. We overregulated the providers and said, if someone walks in your door, you have to take care of them, regardless of if you're going to get paid. And we gave them no choice on how to do that. We just said, you have to do it, which impacts their profit and loss plan. Anybody that's ever run a business knows that you've got to budget your revenue and you've got to budget your expenses. And at the end of the year, you're measured on how well you achieve those goals. Well, budgeting in a provider situation where that provider has no capability to forecast what that expense is going to be for that charitable care that the government now says they have to provide them, we have created problems for that industry's financial status and situation.
So do you think that means that you're not entitled to go into a hospital or emergency room and ask for care?
I think you're entitled to the choice of being able to do that. I don't think you should be directed or that the provider should be directed to say, no matter how bad you are, we're going to take care of you. I believe that as humans, we are going to take care of people. But I think we need to give people the choice of being able to do that. It's costing providers in Idaho $200 million a year in charitable care. That's a lot of money in someone's P&L that they've got to make up for in their revenue. So they charge those expenses, that $200 million of charitable care that they provide, that's charged in their cost. That's where we come up with a $7 Tylenol. Everybody knows a Tylenol doesn't cost $7. But they've got to make up for that charitable care somewhere. So those of us who have insurance, those of us who have the means to pay for that care, pay for that charitable care in one form or fashion.
So the dollars and cents argument has not been persuasive with your fellow legislators.
No.
And I think the advocates in the room would testify that making an argument based on eliminating expenses to the CAT fund and other costs to our system has not been the persuasive point. I think Congressman Labrador said we don't have medical care as a human right, but it's a moral obligation.
Right.
So if we have a moral obligation as a society, and yet we don't want to spend the money in the state, and now we're looking at the federal level of eliminating both the mandates and the requirement that the states provide an essential list of benefits, as well as giving the states a chance to opt out and opt out entirely. Where do we go, and how does what's happening in Washington color the decision we're going to make? And I guess that's a long way of saying what's happening this week in Washington, and how is that going to affect Idaho?
And just to get back to the prior question a little bit, I think, you know, a lot of the discussion of whether we view it as a right or not, you know, we seem to get in this discussion of should healthcare operate in a free market? Should it be treated as a commodity? If you're really talking about it in a free market, the healthcare, the services are a commodity. And when you're talking about life and death situations, really the reason EMTALA was passed was because we as a society aren't okay with people dying in the streets. We're not okay with hospitals saying, nope, you don't have insurance, you know, you can go try to find somewhere else. What's happening at the national level right now, so in March, the House Republicans brought forward the American Healthcare Act. It is, you know, it's basically sold as a repeal and replace of the Affordable Care Act. In practicality, they're not due to the less than 60 vote majority that the Republicans have in the Senate. They're not able to fully repeal, so they're using, you know, the budget reconciliation vehicle to peel back certain parts. So the American Healthcare Act was basically their proposal. It kept a lot of the bones of the Affordable Care Act in place, but there were some things that were peeled back. Our organization, St. Alphonsus, and our parent system, Trinity Health, have opposed the American Healthcare Act because, you know, two main reasons are the erosion in coverage. We've made these gains in coverage where we have over, you know, 20 million people who've gained coverage since 2010 who didn't have it previously. And under the AHCA, we would see about 24 million people lose coverage over the next 10 years. And zeroing in on the Medicaid program, which cares for our most vulnerable citizens, you know, they've looked at restructuring how that would be paid for. It's a partnership between the federal government and the state governments. And the feds pay the bulk of the share. The state currently pays about 30%. But what they've talked about is trying to cap the federal spending using block grants, using per capita caps, different mechanisms, and using the, you know, it sounds tempting to say we'll be offering states flexibility. That sounds great. But the way it was scored out was $840 billion in federal cuts to Medicaid over the next 10 years. So you can call it what you would like, but it's basically shifting responsibility for caring for the most vulnerable to the states. And we have great concern about that. We would prefer to see a waiver mechanism stay in place like Indiana was able to use. Our Healthy Idaho plan that the governor's work group fashioned was loosely based on the Healthy Indiana plan, which Vice President Pence was involved in that. Seema Verma, who was appointed the head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, she was really the architect of the Healthy Indiana plan. It incorporates conservative principles. We would like to see a waiver mechanism kept in place where Idaho could leverage its federal tax, its federal share back to cover our citizens the way that works in Idaho.
So wouldn't new flexibility for the states help Idaho figure out how to cover the gap population? Wouldn't that new flexibility help Idaho? And let me ask the senator, and then I'll get you to respond as well.
Well, I think one of the things that we have to all agree on, in order to fix this, everybody's ox has got to be gored. The providers have got to change the way that they do business. Insurance companies have got to change the way that they do business. Premium payers of insurance are going to have to change the way that we pay our premiums. And the public is going to have to buy into the fact that we need to keep ourselves healthy. Our society in the U.S., we have just assumed when I break my arm, I go to the doctor, it's going to be taken care of. When I get a cold, when it gets bad enough, I'll go to the doctor, it'll be taken care of. That's just how we have grown up. We've not grown up and taught that keeping ourselves healthy is going to cost us less in the long run. It's going to allow us to live longer, and it's a less of a burden on society. So that's a huge number of oxes that we're going to have to gore to fix this problem. The hospital systems, I get the fact that they would like to try and keep things as much as status quo as they can. But again, that business model is going to have to change. We're going to have to start looking at more comprehensive managed care systems where it's based on, instead of fee-for-service, it's based on keeping people healthy. We have started in Idaho direct primary care physicians now that you pay them a fee per month and you go see them as many times as you'd like, and they will help keep your diabetes in check, keep your heart disease, help you, your obesity. They will help you with those things where you don't have to worry about copays. You don't have to worry about paying your 20% of the 80% of your insurance or whatever that might be. But that only takes the primary care level. And that's where I believe it's got to start.
So do you think that having Vice President Pence and the woman from Indiana in charge of Medicaid gives Idaho a chance to get to the point you just said you want us to be?
I hope that it does. CMS, we discussed the Indiana model in the task force. And all of us looked at that and said, wow, yeah, this is the direction that we need to go. But then the presenter we had from back east said, well, although you really like it, CMS has said that they will never approve a waiver for an Indiana-like model again.
That was under the Obama administration.
Exactly.
Right.
And so, we were all thinking, okay, well, depending upon the elections in November, we're going to have a couple of different directions that we're going to be able to go. And so, and that, at the time that we finished up our task force, it didn't look like President Trump was going to win.
So, are you encouraged that we could adopt an Indiana-style model, or are you less encouraged given the direction that's happening in Congress?
I think it's absolutely something that we should be exploring. There are, as soon as I believe it was right after the AHCA was pulled, they didn't actually hold the vote. They got very close. They knew they didn't have the votes. They pulled the bill. And the state of Kansas rapidly, their legislature moved forward with an expansion model. Their governor vetoed it over, concerns over Planned Parenthood funding. But we know that other conservative states are having dialogue with CMS about waiver options. And there's really no reason we shouldn't be taking advantage of the opportunity to have that conversation. Because I do think, even though under the Obama administration, they didn't want to look at any other Indiana-like models, this is different. We're in a different world now, and I do think that they would be open. CMS is more open to these conversations than they were before. And in Idaho, we are uniquely positioned to do something like this, because if you take our state health innovation program, for an example, through the newly created Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation that was created through the ACA to test new models of delivery and payment, Idaho received one of those grants and pulled together the State Health Innovation Plan, which focuses on revamping primary care, the primary care model, so that it is a patient-centered medical home model. It's a team-based care model. The payment of it is different. It's based on a per member per month, where the provider is incentivized to keep people well. It incorporates mental health, and it looks at the broader community around healthcare. We know that social determinants of health are huge, that if people don't have these other social issues dealt with in their lives, their health will never improve. If they have transportation barriers, if they're hungry, we have to think more broadly about healthcare than just the clinic and the hospital setting. So this SHIP group that came together, the governor appointed the Idaho Healthcare Council that governs that. It's got broad participation. We are unique because we can get everybody the major players in Idaho around the table. A lot of states can't do that. We're very competitive with a lot of things because we're small. Now, we're very regionalized in the state, and we have challenges when it comes to the rural nature and our provider availability and some of the others. But we use telehealth as much as possible. We have some real assets going for us, and we can test things. We can be a nice laboratory for the rest of the country in developing a great model.
The challenges that I think we have is my bill was going to allow us to basically go down that road and start to work with CMS to get a waiver to create that a similar model. The problem with that bill was it was limited in the amount of money we could spend. It was only going to be state money, so there wasn't enough money. So we lost some votes because there wasn't enough money. And we lost too many votes because CMS was still in this churning business of what are we going to do now because we have a new administration. And so I could not get the 36, 18, and 1 votes that I needed to get that bill passed so we could at least start down that road. So is what will happen next? Legislature's out of session. Congress is going to do something. Next session is going to be an election year. Will we be able to get a bill that will garner 36 House votes, 18 Senate votes, and the governor to be on board to create a model such as that, or to start to create a model that will bend the cost curve of the providers, not the insurance folks, but the actual health care providers? That's where we need to focus our...
And what's the answer to that question? It's an election year.
That's right. That's the answer to the question. We're going to have the public be vocal about what the right answer is. Right now, there's not a single one of us in here who's not experienced higher insurance premiums. Not a single one of us. And that's going to continue to go up. And until we start to bend the cost curve of the people providing that care, that will be the result every year.
So we've had two questions here asking for just a quick outline of what the Indiana model is or does. Could you do that 25 words or less?
It does leverage the federal Medicaid match.
So that's how it's financed.
So that's big, you know. So that's what we're lacking here. Right. Senator Hagedorn, did his best to advocate for a model where we would appropriate some state funds to do something for part of the gap population and have a provision in there where we could have those conversations with CMS.
Right.
About waiver options. With Indiana, what they have is they've been able to leverage the federal match, and then they have pieces in there where the conservative principles that they have are maximizing the cost sharing. You know, you're limited somewhat in the copays that you can charge to somebody that's on Medicaid. They're at the very lowest end of the income spectrum, and so you don't want to create a barrier to them accessing care that is needed.
But the Indiana plan does give people a skin in the game.
Yes,
right.
There's
right.
some skin in the game because you know you've got the copays that are some leverage, and so with those, they have these healthy behavior incentives.
Right.
So, you know, if your plan, your health plan with your physician, if you're a smoker. Your incentive might be if you quit and we test you and you've shown that you've quit, we're going to waive your copays. We're going to waive some of your cost sharing. If you are overweight and you go to Weight Watchers or you join a gym or walk or whatever it is that the doctor recommends for you to do and you get back within a healthy BMI, we'll waive your skin in the game. And so those principles were very appealing to the governor's work group when we looked at it because they really, we had 4 Republican legislators on the 2014 work group and they really wanted to see a way where there would be some accountability on the individual receiving those benefits.
And the ability, the state's ability right now, we don't have the ability to do that.
Right.
And that was our objective, just using Millennium Fund money, which was state money, we could do that as a state under the program that we were trying to create. Maybe have people be involved in Department of Labor and education and getting themselves better educated to get themselves a better job. Obesity, diabetic training, all of those things we wanted to try and wrap up into this. But we didn't have, again, we didn't have the votes. And so the Indiana model is a great model, I think, just to set as a baseline of what can be done, to have to start to impact the behavior of the people that are overutilizing the system because of their lifestyles.
So for our radio audience, I just want to remind them that this is a Boise City Club Forum exploring the Medicaid gap with Senator Marv Hagedorn and Corey Serber. Let me follow up on your last point. You have said before that one of the reasons why neither of the working groups were successful is there weren't enough legislators who got well enough educated on the issue during those two rounds. Although maybe the third round doesn't support your argument, but what should we be doing to get legislators informed so that we can get to action?
This is a big problem. I mean, the issue of healthcare delivery and how we pay for that is a huge problem. It's very fragmented in Idaho. We've got the catastrophic fund, we've got indigent funds in the county, we've got the high-risk pool. We've got the federally qualified hospitals, we've got free clinics, we've got charity care going on at all of the other hospitals and clinics. No one should be going without health care unless they choose that. The problem that we have is it's expensive the way that we're paying for it. When someone chooses on the street to go to the emergency room when they have pneumonia, that's the most expensive way that we can treat that. We have to get that person to change their behavior to go to a primary care physician when they start to get the sniffles. And figure out, and that's a hard thing to do. So the public needs to understand all of the oxes that need to be gored and needs to start to have a dialogue with all the legislators of this is what the problem is, and it's not going to be solved by one piece of legislation. We're going to have to take this, eat this elephant one bite at a time, and see what direction the elephant's going to go in.
So is your 2018 bumper sticker going to be willing to gore your ox?
If that's what it's got to be, yeah, that's what it'll be.
What did the working groups need to do to get more legislators involved, or sure. What do we need to do next?
Well, and I think Senator Hagedorn just made the perfect argument for why now is the time to move forward and close the gap in Idaho, because we truly do have this fragmented system, this safety net that has holes in it that lets people fall through. People die every year. About 100 people die a year due to lack of access. They put off. Now, you can argue that they shouldn't go without, that they could go into an emergency room. In some communities, they may have access to a federally qualified health center. They may be able to access a medical group like ours that has a charity care policy and accepts people with limited income. But it's so fragmented, and we've got these indigent programs that tax us at the county level, they tax us at the state level for this system that's paying for episodic care. It's paying for the sick care for the people that broke. And what we're not paying for, well, we could get rid of those programs and create one seamless system, leveraging back the taxes we are already paying into the federal government, leverage our tax dollars back to Idaho, and create a more seamless system where people have coverage, not access to a piece and a part and the emergency room, but coverage. People's outcomes and their longevity are largely based on whether they have a usual source of care. And that's what we have the opportunity to do here. We have great providers, and we have free clinics that offer services. They're limited days, limited hours, limited capacity. We have emergency rooms. We have federally qualified health centers. We have charity going on. But it's not enough. It's not the answer to what we really need. Now, what the work group, it would, and this is a tricky thing to say, but to have the governor pick it up as a priority. The statement he made in his State of the State after our 2014 work group was he asked the legislature to look at the findings of the 2014 work group. And that's not as strong a statement as saying, I want you to pass something. So there is that, but it was the governor's work group. You know, he asked us to study the issue. We studied it, and we came up with a recommendation. It was our second recommendation. But because of the exchange vote and how difficult that was within the Republican Party, and it split the caucus, and the governor knew that, he knew he would be asking the legislature to make a very difficult vote, and that they were really seeing this issue as exchange part two. And that discussion and vote were probably the most difficult, as I've talked to people, it's the most difficult vote they've ever taken. And, you know, I personally struggle with why, but that was the fact. It was difficult, and it fractured the party. And so they make very sure that they don't fracture the party that way again. And so the governor took a measured approach in saying, you know, hey guys, I think that here's something you should look at. But he wasn't going to try to shove it down anybody's throats. So, but the number of legislators on the whole that got to see that, you know, the whole legislature didn't see a presentation of the findings of the work group. It was really the health and welfare committees.
So the politics are different now.
Right.
We have a Republican president. We have a Republican Congress. So why can't the governor, or why can't a legislator or a group of legislators say, Obama's gone. We are a Republican state. We're a Republican legislator. We're going to work with our Republican president, and we're going to get a Republican plan for conservative Idaho. Why haven't we taken that step?
The fact of the matter is, the problems that we've had all along is we know, the legislators know, as a country we cannot afford to continue to borrow money to pay for things like this. And that's a very high hurdle for a lot of us to get over. We're $19.7 trillion in debt. Our president and our current Congress, I think, recognize that. I think you will see in a continuing resolution that they're discussing now, and in their health care plans they're discussing this week, we're going to see some reductions in funding of those things. So had we gone down the road of accepting dollars that we knew were not going to exist 4 or 5 years later, that the taxpayers of Idaho were more likely going to have to pick up, was unacceptable. And I think it's still unacceptable for a lot of the legislators. Depending upon what this continuing resolution comes up with, what funding is going to be available, and what sideboards are going to be set on the health care that they're discussing, that's going to drive our legislature and where we think we can go with the dollars from current taxes that are available, with our Millennium Fund dollars, and as long as we have the flexibility to utilize those dollars, like an Indiana model, or to start to move into that type of a model, I think until we see what happens at the end of the week or the weeks following that, we're not going to know what the legislature is going to be able to do.
So we've got several questioners asking about other things we might want to look at. One questioner says, Corey correctly states that even though the U.S. spends the most, we don't rank the highest in the world. Could you tell us how many of the countries at the top of the list have single-payer plans? And I guess the question behind this is, why aren't we looking at that?
Well, that's a quick answer. Most have single, or they have some sort of universal
coverage.
Yes. I'd like to respond just briefly to the previous question, though, on the federal deficit, because that has made a really nice argument, and it is a legitimate problem. Our nation's debt load is a serious issue. That has been one of the arguments against accepting our federal share since the beginning. But lawmakers seem more than willing to accept federal funds for transportation, for education, for other purposes. In the most recent year, I think Idaho accepted about $2.5 billion in federal funding. That doesn't include things like ag subsidies that don't flow through the state, but $2.5 billion. And if we look forward to when we could maybe get a Medicaid expansion done, we would maybe draw down about $484 million. So that's not more than, you know, we're drawing down for these other reasons. And I just have a little difficulty with drawing the line at poor people. Why would we try to solve the nation's debt problem on the backs of the most vulnerable people? Us not accepting our share of federal Medicaid funding is not going to solve the nation's debt crisis. Congress needs to come together to do that in a comprehensive way. And we know that Medicaid, the whole Medicaid program and the funding for it, is a big piece of that. In that, you know, whether it be the AHCA finally passing, whether it be then, you know, Congress has to look at raising the debt ceiling coming up. They have to look at reauthorizing the state children's health insurance program in September. There's a number of opportunities this year where if they don't do a comprehensive health reform plan, we're not safe. Our Medicaid funding still isn't safe because it's still a pay-for for tax reform, for other things that the administration wants to get done. So I'm not minimizing that the nation's debt is a huge issue, and it's a threat. It is a threat. But this isn't where I would draw the line.
And see, I would argue that our Medicaid problem or our Medicaid system is part of our problem. You know, the state does a great job in managing our Medicaid. In fact, we brag a lot about how we're able to take care of so many people at less cost than what other states do. Well, what that does is it adds to that charitable care that the providers give that gets passed on to our insurance companies. So you squeeze the balloon at one end. It doesn't matter whether you're squeezing it with charitable care or with low-paying Medicaid dollars. The other end gets bigger. And the other end is where all of us pay in our premiums.
So going back to your most recent question on single payer. So, you know, how many other industrialized nations do that is just you pay through your taxes. Now, you know, many of them do have some sort of a hybrid. And I could see the rationale for, I don't think that, you know, I do believe that basic health care is a right. I don't think that it's a right to go get a facelift and have others pay for it or other cosmetic or optional elective type surgeries. But basic care, I see the same as K through 12 education or police protection or fire protection, that I would think that it would make sense for us to have a system where people have basic care, they've got the primary care, maybe tax-funded, and then there's a middle. And then you would be protected at the catastrophic level as well, but have some skin in the game in the middle somewhere. Some model like that. It was interesting, recently Congressman Simpson spoke at a congressional forum, and his prognostication was if they don't come to some sort of agreement on the AHCA or some repeal and replace package or some way to fix the problems with the ACA, as perceived by Congress, that single payer would be the next thing discussed. And, you know, that's maybe a dramatic statement to make, but it's been something that there hasn't been a lot of broad discussion on. But many other countries do it that way. I don't know that anybody's got the magic. That's the difficult thing, is you look around the world and, you know, there's pros and cons of all these different ways of doing things.
And having lived under a single-payer system for 20 years of my life in the Navy, and once I retired, I was also, I'm eligible for VA care, which is a single-payer system. And I choose to pay for insurance and use a private system because of my experiences with a single-payer system. And so, although there are, I mean, there are different these different options, one of the things I really enjoy about Corey and I's discussions is that we look at things from different perspectives. And I think all of us need to continue to do that to find that sweet spot. I mean, is it a primary care system somehow subsidized to keep people healthy? Is it people should pay for their own primary care system to keep them healthy and then subsidize the more expensive care? I don't know what the real answer is, but people are not healthy. People are going in when they're sick instead of trying to stay healthy, and it's costing all of us more. And in Idaho, we have a fragmented system that's not working as well as it should, and we're all spending more.
And the payment system feeds into that, too.
Yeah.
Until we're entirely away from a fee-for-service system that rewards the healthcare system for volume of services provided, if we're on that treadmill, then that incentive is what it is. If you go towards something like they're doing in the SHIP model that rewards providers, that you get a guaranteed source of income, a per member per month payment, and you have to report your quality indicators, and maybe you've got some payment at risk based on your quality. That is something that, you know, you get what you pay for. Well, so if what we want is healthier people, how do we pay the system to produce healthier people? That means paying for things that the healthcare system doesn't pay for now. I help lead a walking program that meets every Monday, and we try to start every week on a healthy foot. And it's about creating a healthy community and support around people just to live a healthier lifestyle. That's not something you get paid for.
One of the things that really opened my eyes, just very quickly, that I learned in a task force, a lot of people testify before us. One primary care provider, there was a fee-per-service provider, came in and said they can spend an average of 7 minutes per patient in primary care with that patient. They have to have between 3,000 and 3,500 patients per month to keep the doors open, and they're spending 40% of their revenue on getting their insurance payments to cover their expenses. A direct primary care provider that was on a per month payment schedule needed between 800 and 1,000 patients every month, spent 35 minutes with every patient, and didn't have the 40% overhead that the fee per service primary care provider had. So that's a business model that's really working. The problem that we have with that business model, I mean, all of us would say, well, yeah, let's do that. We're 49th in the nation for the number of primary care doctors that we have. So we don't have enough doctors to do that, which creates another problem that we have to focus on. So,
which is why the medical home model is so promising, because it leverages the advanced practitioners, the nurse practitioners, PAs, to help maximize the use of the limited resource we have, that is the primary care doc. You've got to have a team-based care environment. But, you know, within direct primary care, you still need something that's incentivizing the outcome. The patient outcome is we need to manage population health, not just individual health anymore.
So you may have answered this question with this very conversation, but this questioner says, so St. Al's and Senator Hagedorn have diametrically different ideas they've expressed. St. Al's wants paying customers. Senator Hagedorn wants people to have health care and health insurance. How can those two ideas ever be reconciled?
That's a great question.
Continued conversation and compromise.
Yeah, I think that's where it's going to go. I mean, we have to help, when I say we, all of us, not just the state, but all of us need to help St. Al's and St. Luke's and all of the providers figure out how they can cut their costs. I mean, they have a P&L that they have to manage. And at the end of the day, at the end of the year, whether they're a nonprofit hospital or a for-profit provider, they answer to the public or to their stockholders for their margin targets. Anybody that's in business knows that's what you do. We have to help the providers cut their costs so we don't continue to pay $7 for Tylenol.
So that is a good reason why we are shifting a fair amount of our advocacy resources towards the major drivers of preventable disease and premature death, obesity and smoking.
Right.
And yes, we need to pay the healthcare system differently, pay it for health. But we can say people should just live more healthy lives. But we have a lot of influence over the environment that they live in and the policies that help to make the healthy choice the easy choice for people.
And society. And
to make neighborhoods walkable and bikeable, to encourage breastfeeding as something that gets children off to a good start and prevents childhood obesity, to target tobacco policy, to, you know, any number of things in tobacco and obesity policy. We need to focus on those things. What we're working on, trying to raise the legal sale age for tobacco products so that less kids are starting. The tobacco companies know if they don't get a young person hooked by age 21, they never will. And so our young people are at risk, and so we're trying to target public policy there. As a health system, that is how we bring down costs, is to reduce those chronic diseases. Because that's what's filling up our hospital, is people with diabetes and, you know, heart disease and lung cancer and any number of things that are contributed to by things that we can do something about in policy.
It reaches into our education system where we don't have PE any longer, right? I mean, we're talking about healthcare, but we could be talking about our education system to require our kids to have some physical education classes.
But we can't just expect people to go live healthy lives if we don't set something up in our society that builds that in.
So this is the ox-goring segment of our program. You opened the door by talking about your insurance.
Right.
So several people want to know about legislators getting insurance, legislators getting public subsidies, and if it's not a right, why do legislators feel entitled to it? Here, this questioner says, why would the Idaho legislature be willing to give up, would the legislature be willing to give up their taxpayer-funded health insurance, as there's nothing in the state constitution that says they're entitled to it?
One of the things I think is very important to understand that the federal congressmen have a different health system or insurance system than Idaho does. We have the same insurance system that all of the state employees have. And so I pay monthly just like any other state employee in the room would pay. So I have nothing any more special than any other state employee pays. I don't have to have any insurance, quite frankly, because I'm a retired military. I have TRICARE. I can go to the VA and I can utilize those services. But I choose to pay for my insurance.
What irritates people is that legislators get the insurance that full-time employees get.
That's a very good point.
So how would you adjust that? Change the payment so you're paying, what, a part-time employee?
I ran a bill actually this year to recognize legislators as part-time employees with the same benefits, but that didn't go very far. But that's what I would recommend, yeah.
Here's a questioner who says, what are the cost savings of closing the gap with federal funds versus a state-funded primary care approach? We've talked a little bit about costs and responsibilities, but this kind of gets at one of the essential debates Idaho has had.
Right.
About $100 million over 5 years is what we would save. And part of that...
By federal money.
Yes, by leveraging our federal match, we would save about... It's over $100 million, but I'll put it about there. There's some savings there that the last time the governor's work group met, we knew that there were savings there when it came to recidivism, preventing some percentage of recidivism, because we have quite a percentage of people who are in our prison system due to behavioral health issues, whether they be mental illness that went untreated or substance use disorders, that sort of thing. They go through the prison system, they may get treated while they're there, and then when they're released, they may have a 7-day supply of their medication. When that runs out and they don't have coverage and they don't have a source of care, no surprise, there's recidivism. and they're back in the system. And so we were able to get, I believe it was Milliman, the actuaries that we worked with in the governor's work group, that they put a percentage on the amount that they thought we could prevent. And I think it was around 12% of recidivism could be prevented, but it's a savings that comes from that is about $12.6 million a year just in correction savings. And so that goes into the five-year $100 million savings.
And the problem that the legislature had was that didn't pencil out until later in the program, 5 to 7 years out, is where we actually started to see our savings. And most of us felt that the federal government wasn't going to be able to afford that 5 to 7 years out. So how would we ever get to the point of that penciling out? And is what would happen is we would have established a program, this was the debate, we would have established a program that we would have to continue to get those savings 5 to 7 years out, but we would have had to somehow change, either increase our taxes or move revenue from the education or public safety budgets into health and welfare budgets. And no one was willing to go down that road.
Well, actually, I think according to the Milliman numbers, the savings are greater in the earlier years. The federal match is greater in the earlier years. And then later on, the savings diminish some. But even over a 10-year horizon, it's still a positive thing for Idaho.
We have about 1 minute left. So I want to ask you to answer this one very quickly. Anyone who works full-time and earns enough to qualify for subsidized insurance policy through Your Health Idaho, why would we provide free Medicaid to able-bodied adults when they can work and perhaps get subsidized care? So I guess the question is, why should we be providing health care to people who are not disabled?
We're incentivizing the wrong behavior.
By doing that?
Yes.
So are you talking about the gap population that doesn't get subsidies or the people in the exchange that do get subsidies? If they do get subsidies, those are people that are earning enough income. They're working. You know, we, in Idaho, our average household income, I think, is somewhere in the 40,000 range. So a lot of people in Idaho, 60% of people who use the exchange get a subsidy. You know, I think what it's allowing to happen through getting those subsidies is they can access insurance when they couldn't before.
But
they're getting insurance that has
the incentive is
benefits.
To keep them in that subsidy area
and not make
more money. And that's the issue.
I don't know of many people that wouldn't like to make more money.
But you would argue that giving people access to health care and making sure they're covered is a benefit to society and to
yes.
the state and ultimately to
all
the
economy.
Of us.
Sure.
Well, we've answered all our questions. Our time is up. I want to thank Corey Serber. I want to thank Senator Hagedorn. I would like to thank Delta Dental for being one of the sponsors of today's forum. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you all.
You've been listening to the City Club of Boise, a nonpartisan forum discussing important issues of the day in a nonpartisan, civil manner. The next City Club Forum is on the 17th of May and will present three viewpoints on the business of cannabis, what it means to states who've created a legal market for marijuana, and what it could mean for Idaho. Find on-demand audio of this and other forums, learn about becoming a member, and see a schedule of upcoming events at cityclubofboise.org or by calling 208-371-2221. Connect on Facebook and Twitter by searching for City Club of Boise.